1987, Irish schoolteacher Roddy Doyle self-published a novel about a group of unemployed youth in Dublin. They started a soul band called The Commitments. The book was a hit. The story was adapted for the screen, which is where the song came from, and then again for the stage. The story of The Commitments and their manager, Jimmy Rabbit, has stood as a snapshot of 80s life in Ireland. But time goes on, and life changes. Commitments author Roddy Dowell visited our studio last week to talk with Steve Scheer about what his fictional character, Jimmy Rabbit, is up to almost 30 years later.
Jimmy Rabbit's back with 4 kids.
Yes.
And a loving wife.
Yeah.
And cancer.
Yeah.
Cheery way to start.
Loving wife, yes. Cancer, less so. I've been writing quite a bit about middle age. It's one of the good things about being a writer that you can use the daily humiliations of growing older as your material. It means less and less people read it, and men don't read fiction, of course. They just read books about war and, you know, football and baseball and stuff. But I wanted to write a novel about a year in the life of this middle-aged man, a character that I last thought about when he was quite young. And giving him cancer seemed, in the context of the book, reasonable. I wouldn't inflict it on anybody in reality.
I like the way you said that, though.
Yeah. But I think about 15 years ago, maybe, cancer was introduced as on the agenda of, you know, when I'd meet friends for a pint. It used to be football, music, children, work. And then cancer was added, you know. There were 5 of us, old school friends, used to meet, and now it's 4 of us. And other friends had various forms of cancer. Some have lived, some haven't. So I deliberately gave him cancer of the bowel because I knew from observation that if it was detected early enough, he'd probably survive. But it just struck me as giving him cancer in this way, condensed into a short space of time, an awful lot of things that we confront perhaps over the decades as we grow older. What'll I do with the rest of my life, for example? He feels that to a degree with his older children already. But if you're dying, or you feel you're dying, or there's a possibility that this time next year you won't be around, it kind of hits you on the forehead with a bit more violence than perhaps it does if your health prospects are clearer.
How'd you feel at the end of the book? Did you get a clearer sense of what you'd set out to do?
I never actually have too clear a sense of what I'm setting out to do anyway. I don't plan meticulously. My writing, if it's successful at all creatively, it needs the meanders and it needs the little seemingly pointless moments that are actually the stuff of real conversations a lot of the time. But the difference being that in fiction, conversations have to serve a purpose as well, whereas very often in real life they don't. I did know that he was going to go to the Electric Picnic Rock Festival, which is a real festival. And I did know that he was going to go with friends. And I didn't know health-wise he'd be fine, but I didn't know how I was going to get there or how exactly it was going to go for him at it. That came in the actual writing.
Why did you want him to go to that festival? Why was that
important? Well, I go myself every year, so I don't need to research the mud.
Aren't you too old to be going to rock festivals?
This festival is designed for people exactly like me. In most cases, I'd feel a bit of a freak, but this one is actually designed for the more mature fan, and actually younger people as well. I think the iPod generation, they've got great knowledge of old music. So you would get on the bill, you'd get the up-and-coming bands, but you also get the reformed bands, bands that, you know, had a few hits in the 80s and they'll play for an hour in a tent in the afternoon or whatever. So it fits lots of bills, you know. You get great, great new music, and then you get the fun of old music and a bit of nostalgia and good coffee and outrageously expensive organic burgers.
That's right.
Yeah.
Roddy Doyle is the author of 10 novels, short stories, Rory and Ida, which is a memoir of his parents. He's written 5 children's books. He writes for The New Yorker, McSweeney's, others. The Commitments, did we first meet these characters in The Commitments or The Van?
The Commitments. Jimmy was the manager of The Commitments. So I was beginning to write The Commitments in January and February of 1986, so 28 years ago. Yeah.
Hey, when you go to that festival, do you like seeing those old bands, those one-hit wonders?
Depends
play?
On the bands. A few years back, Mark Almond, who used to be in Soft Cell, played, and he was absolutely brilliant. And I wasn't the biggest fan of Soft Cell, but he played and he sang and played as if he'd written the songs the day before yesterday. But then I went to, last time I was at it, that band Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark were playing, a Liverpool band. They'd some lovely, lovely singles 30-odd years ago, and they were dreadful, really. Nice fellas, but they were actually so self-deprecating and sneering at themselves, it just seemed a little bit obscene. You know, the difference between a good and a bad gig sometimes, leaving aside the quality of the music, is whether the people on stage give the impression that they're up there because they want to be.
Okay, so this is why I asked you this. So the Beatles had their 50th anniversary of being on the Ed Sullivan Show. Well, Paul and Ringo did, with Yoko and Sean in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting about it was that Ringo and Paul seemed to be better than ever, and especially Ringo. He looked great for a 70-year-old in terms of his feeling. It wasn't nostalgia for him.
No. You know, they're such godheads, really. But even if you had a couple of singles 30 years ago, a few hits, and then you go about your life and nobody wants to know anymore, and you end up working as a teacher or in the civil service or back on the farm or something, and then you get the opportunity to go back up on stage. I suppose it could all end in tears, but if you just feel the exhilaration of being on the stage again, it must be extraordinary. It must be brilliant. Yeah.
Did you feel that way when you had the commitments on stage after all those years of writing it, hearing the music?
I did, to a degree. I wrote the script as well, so I was involved from the get-go, and I was at the rehearsals, so I saw the whole thing coming together, which was a fantastic experience. And I did find it satisfying that the work and the interest in the work was still there so many years after, because I self-published the book initially in Dublin, you know?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
you did?
Yeah, I did. So it's really nice to think that almost 30 years later, it still has an audience there and it still has a readership. That's really good. Most of the cast weren't born when I wrote the book.
What possessed you to self-publish a book back before there was the internet and Twitter and
Nobody
Facebook?
Nobody else was interested in publishing me, so I didn't want to become a bitter, twisted man before my time. So I was working full-time as a high school teacher and did a bit of homework with a friend as to how much it would cost. And it would have cost about the same amount if I'd wanted to buy a second-hand car. And I wasn't interested in a second-hand car because at the time I lived very close to a commuter train station and the school I was teaching in was right beside. And I always thought cars were a bit of a hindrance, actually. They got in the way. So I just published the book myself. It was a great adventure, really terrific decision. I think if I did it today, it would probably disappear and, you know, nobody would notice. But back then, because the tables with the new books, they were all books that were published in the UK. Nothing published in Ireland, really.
You know, it's interesting. 80s Ireland, pretty crappy economy.
Yeah.
And here we are again, and Jimmy Rabbit's dealing with a pretty moribund economy in Ireland.
One of the reasons, again, I brought him back, you know, because he doesn't exist as a human being at all. He exists only in words. But I kind of left him in 1980-something or other and then lifted him and dumped him in 2012. So he went from being a 21-year-old man living in a recession to being a 47-year-old man living in an even deeper recession. And he has no idea what happened in between.
Well, he had all those kids.
He said, where did they come from? And a mortgage.
And a mortgage, that's right. Well, that sort of sounds
It reminds me of the Talking Heads song, "This is not my beautiful house, this is not my beautiful life, once in a lifetime."
Well, don't you think a lot of people felt that way when that crash came?
Yeah.
All that, very they were right. Drunk in between.
Well, yeah, I mean, almost immediately people started lacerating themselves and started talking about the lavish lifestyles of the intervening years. And I think, really, they got so moralistic. It reminded me of all those years when Margaret Thatcher was in power and nobody ever admitted having voted for her. So all these economists and columnists saying, oh, what a terrible people we are, look what we've done, look what we've done, as if they were somehow untouched by it all. As if they somehow didn't buy houses and have mortgages or send their kids to private schools or go on 3 holidays a year, you know, and buy skis instead of rent them in a country where it snows about once a century. So it was all very holier than thou and actually quite nostalgic. The immediate nostalgia for the 80s when the word recession started being used again was, you know, I heard their Eurythmics in the background as an economist explained what a recession was to people under the age of 35. You know?
So they were using rock and roll?
They were, yeah. So it nudged me in the direction of writing the book because it's a very different recession. I mean, well, I, you know, was a young man in the last recession, but I grew up in a country where nothing was really expected. It was post-colonial. It was the poor country of Europe. And not an awful lot was expected of us individually or collectively. We emigrated. Luckily, I never had to, but at one point I was the only one of my siblings living in Ireland.
Is that right?
Yeah, the rest had emigrated. And now, you know, in the intervening years, then they could all come back and were expected to think that that was a bad thing, living beyond their means. It meant that people who had to live abroad came home. So, I mean, the picture was much more complicated. But we didn't fall off anything, so to speak, because there was nothing to fall off. We were at rock bottom anyway. Then the economy lifted, and then when it fell, then there was a huge cliff to fall off. And then an awful lot of things that we thought were certainties, you know, stability, economic stability, jobs, good work for our children, things like that were gone.
Roddy Doyle's latest novel is The Guts. Dialogue is your, what would you call it, the tool that you use to construct your writing?
By and large, in most cases, yes.
Will you read a little bit?
I will.
This is towards the beginning. Jimmy's talking to his dad.
Yeah, Jimmy, in the local pub, or in his father's local pub. She's grand. How's Ma? Grand. Are you having another? No, said Jimmy. I'm driving. Fair enough. I have cancer. Good man. I'm being serious, Da. I know. Jimmy was shaking. He hadn't noticed while he was working himself up to tell his father, but he knew it now. He pressed his hands down on his thighs, made his arms stiff. He wondered if his eyes were bloodshot because they felt like they had to be. Jesus, son. Yeah. What kind? Bowel. Bad. Could be worse. Could it? So they say, said Jimmy. They. The doctors and that. The specialists. The team. The team. Yeah. What colour are their jerseys? Jimmy couldn't think of an answer. It's terrible, said his da. Yep. When did you find out? A few days ago, said Jimmy. Monday. God. Jimmy relaxed his arms. The madness was gone. They seemed to be his again. His father was fidgeting, like he'd found something sharp he'd been sitting on. Then Jimmy knew what he was doing. He was trying to get nearer to Jimmy without actually moving, without making a show. He leaned across the table and put his hand on Jimmy's arm. He kept it there. It's not natural, he said. Cancer? Said Jimmy. I think it is. It's stopped being so bloody reasonable. It isn't natural for a father, a parent like, to hear that kind of news from his child. Well, I had to tell you. Sorry, Jimmy, sorry. I'm making a mess of it. He took his hand off Jimmy's arm and put it back. What I mean is, it should be the other way round. Do you know what I mean? I do, yeah. Jimmy Sr. took his hand away and sat back in his chair. How did Aoife take it? What? Aoife? How was she when you told her? I didn't tell her, said Jimmy. What? I can't. You have to. I know. Never mind the driving. Have a pint.
Roddy Doyle reading from his new novel, The Guts. I like that part about the dad feeling bad.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, he's not. It's not the first person to express that. It just seems... and again, look, I haven't been confronted with the awfulness of that myself, but it would be every parent's nightmare, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just seems so unnatural. And of course then, my own parents are 90 and 88. Their eldest child is in her 60s. So it's getting less unnatural than it used to be. It must be bizarre being the parent of middle-aged children, you know. Bald, fat children. It must be, you know, horribly distorted versions of the babies they were.
Roddy Doyle speaking with KUOW's Steve Scherr about his novel revisiting the story of the people in the Irish soul band The Commitments. The new novel is called The Guts. You'll find a longer version of this interview with music at our website, kuow.org.